From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It's been 11 years since WikiLeaks released footage from the gunsight camera of an Apache helicopter engaged in an attack which killed two journalists and eight civilians in Baghdad, Iraq. The so-called collateral murder video was a shocking document of the U.S. war in Iraq and was greeted with a firestorm of controversy on release. One of the first soldiers on the scene after the air attack, Ethan McCord, was the subject of a short documentary a year later called Incident in New Baghdad. That film was released 10 years ago this month. In it, he briefly describes his personal experience, including saving two children who were wounded in the attack.
We were in Kamalaya, Iraq. We were tasked out that morning to do knock and searches. The Apaches were providing overwatch for us. We had a small firefight, probably about 4 to 5 blocks away from where this incident took place. We heard the Apaches open fire, and what you have to understand is the Apaches, they don't shoot just like little rounds. They shoot 30 millimeter rounds, which are about that big. I didn't know what was going on at the time. I was just told to move to that position. I was on foot, and when to one of the first six guys to run up onto the scene, and what I saw was a group of men on the corner who had been completely obliterated. These rounds explode when they hit, and to me, at the time, they didn't look human. They looked like something you would actually see out of a bad horror movie. Like, oh, this can't be real. I don't know if I thought that, you know, maybe my emotions were kind of shutting everything down and saying, okay, this can't be real. One of the first things I remember hearing was a little girl crying. And I knew that the cry was coming from the van that was there. And I ran up to the passenger side door with one of the privates who was with me, and we looked inside the van, and the private that I was with started vomiting and ran away because he couldn't bear to look at the children the way they were. What I saw was a little girl, she was probably about 4 years old, sitting on the bench seat with a severe belly wound and glass in her hair and in her eyes. She couldn't blink or close her eyes, and she was crying. Like, it wasn't a pain cry, it was a cry that me having children, knowing that my daughter was the same age as this little girl, waking up from a horrible nightmare in the middle of the night, and it was almost blood curdling. Next to her, in the middle of the bench seat, half on the floorboard, with his head resting on the bench seat, was a boy about 7 years old. I immediately thought he was dead because he had a severe wound to the right side of his head. And in the driver's seat was who I assumed was the father, the way he was hunched over them in a protective manner. And he was completely destroyed. There was no way that he had survived. I grabbed the little girl out of the van, yelled for a medic, and we took her to the house that was directly behind the vehicle, where I took off my gloves, got water, and rinsed the wounds, checked for any exit wounds, other wounds that she might have had, and was picking glass out of her eyes with my hands so that she can blink. That's when in the video you can hear the medic say that there's nothing else we can do here, she needs to be evac'd. He takes the little girl and he runs her to the Bradley. I go back outside to the van, and you know, I don't know actually why I went to the van. I thought that the boy was dead and the father was dead, but when I went back out there, the boy took a labored breath, and that's when I started screaming out that the boy's alive. And I picked him up in my arms and started running towards the Bradley with him, the whole time telling him, you know, it's gonna be okay, don't die. And at this point, he looked up at me, just for a split second, then his eyes rolled back into his head, And at that moment, I thought he had died in my arms. But I got him to the Bradley, and when I took him to the Bradley, my commanding officer, or my platoon leader, was there. And he told me that I needed to quit worrying about these MFing kids.
According to McCord, what is seen in that video is one incident of many, and that similar abuses of U.S. military power occur almost daily. 10 years later, U.S. forces are still in Iraq, and now apparently even referencing an event that gained such notoriety so long ago is no longer permitted in the current social media environment. RT America's Rachel Blevins said that her Twitter account was blocked last week after she retweeted the video. Again, that video was first released by WikiLeaks over a decade ago.
I have been officially reprimanded by Twitter and told that I would stay in timeout, locked out of my account, unless I took down a tweet in which I shared the infamous collateral murder video that was published by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks 11 years ago today. Twitter says that I violated their graphic content policy. One of the things that Twitter pointed out was that this video showed the loss of life, and they said that they didn't want footage like that out there on the internet because that could be hard for the families of those victims. You know what's harder for the families of those victims? To know that their family members were murdered and that the people who did it got to walk away with no consequences. Because that's what happened in this case.
Blevins' account was restored, she said, after she pulled down the video. Again, Twitter removed the video, ostensibly over the fact that it depicted violence. McCord describes that violence, which again, he witnessed, in some further detail.
While sitting on the rooftop, I could hear them firing the Hellfire missiles into houses. I saw the pictures of the families that were in these buildings. There were no armed men in these buildings. They were just families, women, children, who were killed. I got back to the FOB later that day, and I remember thinking to myself, I was like, there's no way that we did that. You know, it had to have been the men on the corner. There was one guy who had an RPG and one guy who had an AK-47. And, you know, from being over there, you're like, okay, well, these guys are obviously insurgents if they have weapons, not knowing that these other men were cameramen. And what frequently happens in Iraq is if there's a person with a camera, people will come out of their homes and say, hey, look at me, this is what I have, put me on TV, put me on the news, make me famous, now pay me for my picture. There was no RPG rounds in the RPG. So that, to me, my reaction is that I don't think that they were armed to fight us. They were just showing off for the cameramen that were there. But later on that night in the FOB, while I was washing the blood of the children off of me, I couldn't really cope with it. I was having a hard time dealing with the fact that we did that. The Apaches did that. So I went to my staff sergeant, who was in my line, in my chain of command, and I told him, I think I need to see mental health. I need to go talk to somebody because I'm having a hard time dealing with what I had just seen, what I had witnessed, what I was a part of. And he laughed at me and told me to get the sand out of my vagina and to quit being a pussy and to suck it up and to be a soldier. And so, you know, you kind of like, okay, well, there's nothing else I can do. So you just kind of do, you kind of suck it up, you push everything down, you bottle it up. But that anger and that rage sits inside you, and it gets to the point where it just bubbles over, and you get so angry that you start yelling at people who don't deserve it, family members, your privates, soldiers who are your brothers. And you know, that was just one incident, and I've been saying this for a long time, that was one incident of many that you guys got to see. Things like this happened almost on a daily basis in Iraq. It may not have been an Apache, it could have been a Bradley. I saw a Bradley fire on a van load of children, nothing more than children, and watch the Iraqi police pull bodies out, pieces of children, And the whole time they're looking at us, shaking their heads. And, you know, it's again, that was one incident. But you guys can see from that one incident that we shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. That we're over there and we're killing innocent people. These are people who are only trying to live their lives. And the best that they can during an occupation. I got out of the Army in 2009. I was blown up in Iraq in November of 2007. I came home. My spine was broken. I have metal rods and pins in my back. The Army kicked me out on a Chapter 517, which states that everything that I had, my traumatic brain injury, my PTSD, and my broken spine, were all pre-existing conditions before I joined the military. So I got no benefits from the Army whatsoever. And I'm not the only one. This has happened to over 250,000 soldiers coming home from war. They're saying that, oh, they obviously had this PTSD long before they joined the Army. And, you know, it's not only are the people of Iraq and Afghanistan the victims, but soldiers are the victims themselves. They are being victimized every day, whether they have post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury or military sexual trauma. They're being placed right back into the same traumas that got them that to begin with. They're 4 or 5 deployments. You know, soldiers are just as much the victims. And once I realized that I was being victimized from the military and that they were using me, using what I grew up very conservative. I grew up thinking, you know, it's my duty to serve in the military. When 9/11 happened, I ran out and I joined the military. I have to go serve. I have to go fight the Muslims who attacked us on 9/11. And what I found strange is when I got to Iraq is I felt that I had more in common with the people over there than I did with the people who sent me to war to begin with. And so that day especially, the collateral murder video, I could no longer justify why I was in Iraq, what we were doing in Iraq. I was just watching innocent men, women, and children being slaughtered. There were no so-called insurgents. We would drive around waiting to start something.
Again, that was Iraq veteran Ethan McCord describing the events that he was an eyewitness to, which are depicted in the Collateral Murder movie released by WikiLeaks 11 years ago this month. That video, again, has been banned from Twitter and is being moderated by YouTube. Next, we go to New York for the Wednesday press conference of the Assistant to the UN Secretary General at UN Headquarters, Stefan Dujarric. And we bring you as much of that as time will allow.
Good afternoon. This morning, as you will have seen in a pre-recorded address, the Secretary General spoke at the commemoration for the International Day of Reflection on the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda. The Secretary General paid tribute to the victims and survivors of the genocide and recalled how those days remain in our collective conscious as among the most horrific in recent human history. But he added that we must also take a hard look at today's world and ensure that we heed the lessons of 27 years ago. Around the globe, he said, people are threatened by extremist groups determined to boost their ranks through social polarization, political and cultural manipulation. To prevent history from repeating itself, we need to counter these hate-driven movements that have become a transnational threat. The Secretary General added, saying we must forge a common agenda to renew and reinvigorate our collective actions going forward. And he also spoke to youth leaders today, as well as activists and youth-led organizations at a virtual ECOSOC youth forum. In his remarks, Mr. Guterres said he was immensely saddened by what the pandemic has done to the world's young people, disrupting their education, increasing youth employment, and worsening their mental health. The Secretary General said we should not be surprised that both online and in the streets, young people have been expressing their impatience with the pace of change, their alarm at the war on nature, their frustration with injustice and poor governance. He added that we must listen to them, rebuild their trust, and find ways to engage with them in the governance systems and democratic processes, strengthening work and for youth. He added that young people continue showing the way on critical issues such as racial justice, gender equality, and the climate crisis. The Secretary General's youth envoy, Jayathma Wickramanyake, also spoke at the forum. And the UN mission in Libya will facilitate a three-day meeting of the Libyan Political Forum's Legal Committee in Tunis. That's from the 7th to the 9th of April. That is today, the 7th. That meeting is intended to finalize discussions on constitutional basis, which will pave the way for national elections on December 24th of this year. In his opening remarks, the special envoy of the Secretary General, Jan Kubisch, welcomed the members of the Legal Committee and underscored the importance of efforts to achieve the objective of the roadmap adopted in Tunis last November. The UN mission is fully committed to supporting the holding of national elections in accordance with the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum roadmap and the overwhelming request of the Libyan people. The deliberations of the Legal Committee are a critical element to move the election preparations forward. Turning to Ethiopia, our colleagues tell us that the humanitarian situation in Tigray remains dire. While there has been substantial improvement in humanitarian access, active hostilities have been reported in northwestern, central, eastern, and southeastern and southern zones. Some humanitarian partners have accessed the towns of Gidjet and Samre. In the southern and southeastern zones, they report that most of the population in these towns have fled. The Alamata Mekele Adigrat Shire Road remains partially accessible. Our humanitarian colleagues say that an estimated 2.5 million people in rural Tigray have not had access to essential services over the last 5 months. The conflict continues to drive massive displacement across the regions, with tens of thousands of people moving towards urban areas, including to Mekele and Shire. According to a recent assessment report, there could be as many as 450,000 people displaced in Shire. Our humanitarian partners are grappling with capacity and resource challenges as they scale up their response, which remains inadequate for the estimated 4.5 million people who need life-saving assistance. And turning to Mali, the UN mission there is telling us that peacekeepers have just conducted a long-range patrol covering over 1,200 kilometers from Goa to Tasinga in the center of Mali. This patrol is part of the mission's efforts to provide security and protect civilians in the region that is also known as the Three Borders area. The day and night patrols were conducted over a period of 28 consecutive days. Throughout the mission, peacekeepers maintain constant contact with the Malian armed forces. They also engage with communities to discuss their concern and to better protect local population. Local community members between Asongo and Tasiga reported back to the mission that cases of robbery and theft have not been recorded in the 2 week period coinciding with the peacekeepers' continued patrol of their region. More is online, and the mission has also produced a very nice-looking video of the patrol. And turning to the situation in the Red Sea, I can tell you that we are concerned about another report of an incident in the Red Sea yesterday involving a vessel flying the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the fourth such incident in the region in just over a month. Although the circumstances around the incident remain unclear, we want to underscore the importance for the concerned parties, including countries in the region, to exercise maximum restraint and refrain from taking any escalatory actions, and in particular to respect their obligations under international law. And moving to Ukraine, our humanitarian colleagues tell us that yesterday shelling damaged a power line over the main lift pump. We are told that yesterday, sorry.
It's
Sorry, we are told that yesterday shelling damaged a power line near a main lift pumping station on South Donbas Waterway in eastern part of Ukraine. This interrupted safe water supply for over a million people in 50 nearby settlements on both sides of the contact line. While repair teams were able to quickly fix the damaged power lines today, we reiterate the call for all involved to avoid targeting critical water infrastructure in eastern Ukraine. This year, we, along with our humanitarian partners, require $168 million to help 1.9 million of the most vulnerable 3.4 million people in the east. Only 5.5% of this funding has been received. We also urge all concerned to provide unconditional access to those in need. And a COVAX update for you today from Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic. This morning, Costa Rica received more than 43,200 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. This is the first shipment of nearly 220,000 doses expected to arrive soon. Our colleagues in Costa Rica hailed the arrival as a historic step towards the goal of ensuring access to an equitable distribution of vaccines globally. Meanwhile, the Dominican Republic received more than 91,000 doses last night. This is the first such batch of more than 2 million doses of vaccines expected to be received through COVAX. The UN team has been supporting authorities to address the pandemic, helping to deliver more than 60 tons of protective equipment to health personnel. Speaking of health personnel, today is World Health Day, and the theme this year is Together for a Fair, Healthier World. In his message, the Secretary General notes that the pandemic has revealed how unequal our societies are. He points out that thanks to the COVAX initiative, more nations are now beginning to receive vaccine supplies, but most people in low- and middle-income countries still must watch and wait. The Secretary General stresses that such inequalities are immoral, and they are dangerous for our health, our economies, our societies. He says as we recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, we must implement policies and allocate resources so we can all enjoy the same health outcomes. Celia.
I love to be the first one. James. The UN mission in South Sudan will reduce his staff by 7% this year, but as far as I know, the peace agreement has yet to be implemented. So does the UN think that this is the right thing to do in a country where peace is still very fragile?
Look, I have to tell you, I've seen those reports. I have to get the details of what's going on behind the mission. I think I would point you to what David Shearer said yesterday, that yes, a lot has been achieved. Much remains to be done to consolidate the peace, and that it call on the political parties to work together for the benefit of those involved. Mr. Bays.
So first, on the statement you read out, which I want to assume is about the Iranian ship, the Savis, Israel, according to reports, has notified the US that it carried out this attack. You said that everyone should respect their obligations under international law. If Israel did carry this out, was it a breach of international law?
I mean, I haven't seen those reports. We will look. We have seen what we have seen in the past. In the past month, is a number of attacks on ships that were with different flags, different owners. What we do not want to see is any escalation, tit for tat. The freedom of navigation is critical all over the world, but especially in this region, in the Red Sea and in the Persian Gulf.
So would an attack like the one that we saw there, whoever carried it out, would it be illegal under international law?
I think everyone understands what their responsibilities are, and we want them to be respected.
I just want you to tell us what responsibilities are.
You know, I have to see the details of I can't go any further. This
one other quick question, if I may. There are reports from Washington that the U.S. is about to make an announcement of funding to the Palestinians, money to UNRWA and other monies. Can the UN confirm that it's been notified by the US about this?
Yes, we've seen those reports. It is also our understanding that a major announcement is imminent. Obviously, we welcome this announcement if it turns out to be true, and we have no indication that it's not. We're waiting for the official announcement, but we very much welcome it. The relationship between the United States and UNRWA is a long-standing relationship. We hope that others will now follow suit. There were a number of countries that had greatly reduced or halted contributions to UNRWA. We hope that the American decision will lead others to rejoin UNRWA as UNRWA donors. Edie, and then Stefano.
Sorry, Steph. Thank you. I have two questions. First, the AP has done a major story on the apparent cleansing of Tigrayans. And I wonder if the Secretary General has any comment on what's happening there and what the UN is trying to do to actually document this and prevent it.
Yes, we've read the story, which is a harrowing story. We are very concerned about these latest reports of human rights violations, and we've seen others since the beginning of this conflict. As I understand it, our colleagues at the UN Human Rights Office are in discussions with Ethiopian counterparts to do joint investigations with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. We hope that these investigations will be carried out thoroughly. Part of the prevention is also about access and greater access for humanitarians and for aid personnel, and we continue on that front.
And a second question on Yemen and where Mr. Griffiths is, what he's doing, and is any UN effort being made to try and de-escalate the situation in Ma'arib?
Mr. Griffiths, as I recall, is in Amman. As you know, he had done quite extensive traveling in the last week. He'd been before that he was in Oman and traveled to Riyadh as well. He's continuing his contacts from Amman, and we're continuing our efforts to try to find a way to halt the fighting in Ma'arib. Stefano Vaccara, and then we'll go to the screen.
Thank you very much, Stefan. This is an update on Mario Paciolla case with a question. Recently, an Italian publication with an article by Gabriele Santoro interviewed Colombian prosecutor Giovanni Alvarez Santoyo. He is not just a prosecutor, he works on the organization that for the peace process. He investigates crimes that have been done. So he's involved in the peace process. Well, he asked about what he thinks about the Mario Paciolla case. He say, and I quote, "This death is an attack on the peace process, and then this country is trying to do, and on the quality of the support that the United Nations mission can do on this process." So my question is, in this moment, you know, it's not anymore a question to try to find out the truth about the death of somebody that was working for the United Nations in Colombia. But does the Secretary General think that to find out what really happened to Mario Paciolla means also to help the peace process in Colombia?
Look, we want to find out
what happened to our colleague, first and foremost, for the sake of his family and those around him who have suffered a tremendous loss. It is not for me to prejudge.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.